from Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
There's a 20-some-year-old woman out there that's a medical student in her medical school when the earthquake happened. Was spared life for 3 days and survived by drinking of the blood of other people around her.
As the people of Haiti continue to struggle for survival, we bring you stories of desperation and stories of courage.
Incroyable.
Incredible.
Une force de, une envie de vivre.
She had a desire to live.
J'ai jamais vu ça.
I've never seen that.
And all the prisoners jailed at the National Penitentiary in Port-au-Prince escaped in the earthquake. We'll speak with a leading Haitian human rights attorney. He says 80% of all prisoners in Haiti, perhaps more, have never been charged with a crime. The earthquake set them free. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The recovery effort continues in Haiti amidst a rising death toll and fears of infectious outbreaks among desperate survivors. The European Commission now says around 2 million people have been homeless, up from previous estimates of 1.5 million. More than 10,000 bodies are now being buried in mass graves in a single day. Aid groups are warning of outbreaks of diseases and infections amongst the hundreds of thousands crammed into makeshift refugee camps. The U.S., meanwhile, is being accused of prioritizing the delivery of troops and military equipment over direly needed aid. Doctors Without Borders legal director Francois Saulnier says a plane carrying over 12 tons of aid was turned back from landing three times this week.
Now everything has been mixed together, and the urgent and vital attention to the people have been delayed, while military logistic, which is useful, but not on day three, not on day four, but maybe on day eight, this logic, military logistic has really jammed the airport and, you know, led to this mismanagement, real mismanagement of vital issues.
The Doctors Without Borders plane was diverted to the Dominican Republic, delaying the aid delivery by 3 days. At a Haitian hospital Wednesday, Doctors Without Borders field coordinator Pip Millard said medical workers are struggling to treat earthquake survivors.
We've got a surgical team here who are doing surgery. We're having to do amputations. We've got some really severe wounds, lots of fractured limbs, both arms, legs, many different kind of crush injuries. And also one of the other problems that we're really encountering is lack of supplies. We're running out of things very quickly.
The International Monetary Fund has backed off an effort to impose new loans on Haiti. Last week, the IMF said it would provide Haiti with $100 million under an extension of a previous loan. The initial funds impose conditions including wage freezes for public sector workers, inflation controls, and price hikes for electricity. But after the public outcry, the IMF released a statement claiming the new $100 million will now come without conditions. U.S. immigration officials say they expect up to 200,000 undocumented Haitians to apply for temporary protected status, or TPS, in the coming weeks. The program would grant 18-month work permits to Haitians who were in the U.S. when the earthquake struck. Haitian refugees arriving after the earthquake date will continue to face deportation. We'll have more on Haiti after headlines. President Obama is set to propose new regulations today for large Wall Street firms. The measures would limit the size of large banks, as well as the practice known as proprietary trading, in which commercial banks trade financial securities from their own commercial accounts. Former Federal Reserve Chair Paul Volcker has been a leading advocate for the proposals. He says it would help undo some of the damage of the 1999 repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which had ensured the separation of commercial and investment banking. The expected announcement comes one day after President Obama signed an executive order to crack down on government contractors who avoid paying taxes.
I'm directing my budget office, together with the Treasury Department and other federal agencies, to take steps to block contractors who are seriously delinquent in their taxes from receiving new government contracts. I'm also directing the IRS to conduct a review of the overall accuracy of companies' claims about tax delinquencies.
Previous government studies have found thousands of companies have received government contractors despite owing billions in taxes. 22 executives and employees working in the private military industry have been arrested in a sting operation, accusing them of trying to pay bribes to win lucrative foreign contracts. The FBI says the accused agreed to pay a commission to an FBI agent posing as a representative of an African defense minister, tendering a $15 million deal. The Justice Department says the case is the largest ever under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. The Justice Department has released a report on the FBI's illegal collection of thousands of telephone records between 2002 and 2006. The report says agents obtained information on more than 3,500 phone numbers through emails, sticky notes, and even the practice of computer sneak peeks. On Wednesday, Senate Judiciary Chair Patrick Leahy criticized the FBI.
This was authorized at high levels within the FBI. It continued for years. I understand Director Mueller, the FBI has worked to correct his abuses. But this report is a sobering reminder of the significant abuse of this broad authority. No one is above the law. No senator and no member of the FBI. And there has to be accountability for what happened here.
In Israel and the occupied territories, United Nations agencies have joined with over 80 relief and aid groups to call for an end to the Israeli blockade of the Gaza Strip. UN resident humanitarian coordinator Max Gaylard says Israel's stranglehold over Gaza is endangering Palestinian lives. As aid groups warn about the Israeli blockade of Gaza, Israel's renewing calls for long-term control over the West Bank. On Wednesday, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel must retain large swaths of the West Bank under any peace deal that would establish a Palestinian state. Netanyahu said Israel must also maintain troops in the Jordan Valley, dividing the West Bank from Jordan, surrounding Palestinians from both sides. The incoming Honduran government has signed an accord calling for the exit of the ousted President Manuel Zelaya. On Wednesday, President-elect Porfirio Lobo reached a deal that would grant Zelaya safe passage to the Dominican Republic. Zelaya has taken refuge in the Brazilian embassy since returning to Honduras in September. Lobo was elected in a November race boycotted by Zelaya supporters. Zelaya says he'll review the safe passage deal. In Texas, the presiding judge of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has been cleared of wrongdoing in a closely watched case. Sharon Keller faced five charges of judicial misconduct for refusing to hear a last-minute appeal from a death row prisoner scheduled to be executed that night. Keller denied an appeal from the lawyers for Michael Wayne Richard at 5:20 p.m. on September 25, 2007, saying, quote, "We close at 5." Richard had been on death row for two decades. He was killed later that night by lethal injection. On Wednesday, the special judge appointed to hear the complaint sided with Keller and said she deserves, quote, no further reprimand beyond the public humiliation she has surely suffered. The Obama administration has lifted a Bush-era ban on two Muslim scholars who are barred from entering the United States. On Wednesday, the State Department said Adam Habib and Tariq Ramadan are no longer deemed a security threat and will be allowed to apply for entry visas. Ramadan was offered a position at the University of Notre Dame in Ohio in 2004. The Bush administration initially barred his entry without explanation and then said it was because he once gave money to a Palestinian charity. A South African social scientist, Habib, was deported in 2006 after traveling to the United States for a series of academic meetings. In a statement, the American Civil Liberties Union hailed what it called a major victory and called on the Obama administration to retire the practice of ideological exclusion for good, they said. And the wife of Republican senator and former presidential candidate John McCain has joined a campaign to repeal California's gay marriage ban. On Wednesday, the group No H8 released an ad featuring Cindy McCain opposing Proposition 8, the 2008 ballot measure banning gay marriage. In a statement, Senator McCain said he remains opposed to gay marriage. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Well, Amy, you've just returned last night from Haiti, you and a couple of the producers.
That's right. Sharif Abdelkaddous and also Elizabeth Press worked with us. Kim Ives was working with us as well of Haiti Liberté.
Tell us some of what you saw firsthand.
Well, we're going to continue to bring these reports as we have through the week and encourage people to go to our website at democracynow.org. Also, Sharif was tweeting all through the period, giving people regular updates every single day. Because what has happened in Haiti has completely shaken not only the people of Port-au-Prince. You know, the epicenter is even outside of Port-au-Prince. It's in Laogan, and tomorrow we're going to do a whole story on Laogan. This is where, supposedly, Jean-Jacques Dessalines was married 200 years ago. It is a historic city. But what people are facing now, the amputations, I mean, as one representative of Doctors Without Borders has said, they haven't seen anything like this since the Crimean or the Civil War. And one of the stories we'll be bringing people is the first night we came, there was a kitchen tabletop amputation that was done. We sat and watched as doctors came from Denver Children's Hospital, and they performed this amputation that, in most cases, would have been unnecessary if the patient had received care at the beginning. The number of amputations without anesthesia. Now, let's remember this. It's not only amputations, but it's all operations. Doctors who are unable to get access, and it's amazing to see the influx of doctors from all over, among the many Haitian-American doctors who've come from our area, New York and New Jersey. I mean, to be in the—
That was an amazing story, the interviews yesterday with the various Haitian-Americans who had immediately flown down and gotten
there. That's right. Any which way they have come to Haiti to help their people. And we shouldn't even say their people, because it's our people. It's everyone. And you have seen this tremendous effort. I mean, that is the good news. Global effort to get aid to Haiti. The problem, though, is the bottleneck. Mm-hmm. Oh, there is massive amounts of aid at the Port-au-Prince airport. As to how it's getting out is another question. Later in the broadcast, we're going to speak to one of the leading human rights attorneys in Haiti, who talked about the prison break, you know, after the earthquake, National Penitentiary, all the prisoners out, it's set for 800, it's 4,000 people are there. But he says 80% of them, and also the prisoners around Haiti, haven't even been charged. Okay. And what's ironic is then the UN uses it, or the authorities in general, U.S., to justify not going to areas, saying that there's a security risk. One of our colleagues talked to a soldier who said, as he's getting out food to the people of City Soleil, oh, you know, these people are very peaceful, but we were told that prisoners had escaped. Well, we're going to really look more closely at this. But right now, Juan, we just want to go to our first story. This takes place yesterday, just as we were racing to leave Haiti. We were over at Matthew 25 House, which is a hospitality house, they call themselves. It actually previously had been used to take in people from other countries who had come to work with the different departments in Haiti, people all over, so that people didn't feel, Haitians, that they always have to come to the city, which goes back to Duvalier, that move into the city, and assembly workers, you know, being paid low wages, et cetera. But as we were there, one of the doctors who'd come to help people in Haiti, Dr. Eric Tam, comes from Denver Children's Hospital. He is a pediatrician there, works in the emergency room. He was extremely upset, and he sat at the entry. And let me also say, the entry of the house, where we were not allowed to all go in at once, because just before we left for the broadcast yesterday, that other quake happened that's called an aftershock, but we'll talk about that later, which can kill so many people, because— Well, it's 6.1. The earthquake, the first earthquake, was 7.0. So he was sitting on the steps, and this is the story he told us.
I'm a pediatric emergency physician from the Children's Hospital in Denver.
This is probably not. Hardest case I've seen so far.
There's a 20-some-year-old woman out there that's a medical student in her medical school when the earthquake happened. was barely alive for 3 days and survived by drinking of the blood of other people around her. And she, one of the fathers from one of the parishes around, brought her brought her to us this morning for further care. We put her IV in, and we're hoping to send her to the hospital that had intensive care capabilities. After circling around and probably an hour or so, they finally found the compound where these physicians were. And they took her in, and then they saw that she might have a head injury, so there wasn't much for her to do, so they brought her back here.
Can she speak?
She has been speaking. They said she's lucid.
How has this experience changed you being here?
I mean, I think it's going to take some time for me to absorb all this, and you saw this is the first time I've broken down since I've been here.
We followed Dr. Eric Tom back behind the house to a soccer field where as many as 1,000 people have taken refuge, where Patricia Sherry was, to talk to her.
Tell us your name, how old you are.
Do you know Aquila Ju?
My name is Patricia.
Do you speak English?
No, nom c'est Patricia.
J'ai 23 ans.
Ok, moi j'ai 23 ans.
M'a souffri depuis longtemps.
Ok, I've been suffering for a long time ago.
Chaque fois que je passe, je parle, je n'ai pas mon cibara, je vois ma vie, je me sens.
Chaque côté passé, everywhere I go, they just give me something and just send me home, but without getting ready. That's they just it bring me like this. That's why I'm
what
like that.
What happened to you? What happened?
In
the earthquake.
Les conscience s'est finie. Je suis en tremblement de terre. Regardez, me tomber.
She's learning nurse and. And one time, and she just see the building fall down, and all the rubble, concrete fall on her.
That's finished. Moi, je suis en deux chaises ferrées. Des pressés tout pied moi.
And I was sitting on a chair, and all the concrete fall on me. And the concrete all over my head. They cannot do anything for the head, and she probably go somewhere else just to take care of her head, because everywhere she go, they say no, nothing, nothing.
How did you survive?
Okay. Mm-hmm. When she was under the concrete, and she says that anyway, I cannot stay here. I should do something to get out of there. Mm-hmm. And then I was there since 5 o'clock. Okay, 5 o'clock at night, and I get out at 11 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And I scream out, calling Jesus. Okay, and she was I was thirsty, and then I just drink some water, and I find blood instead of water.
The blood of
The other students were with her.
Who had died?
She says that she already met you. She wouldn't be like this. She would or get everywhere she go, and they don't take care of me. Okay, and they just give me something and say go home with my mother. She's the only girl who get out of there. All it died.
How old are you?
Quel âge?
23.
Okay, my parents living abroad.
Abroad.
Yeah.
Where?
Qui côté?
Washington.
Okay, Washington. She has a phone number of the family.
You are an amazingly strong woman that you survived for this whole week.
This is why we've come here.
You are an important model of strength and courage for all of us.
Un modèle de monde, okay? Qui a pile courage. Okay?
Okay. We will call your father.
And that's just what we did. That's Patricia Sherry, a 23-year-old nursing student who was caught in the rubble. She was at school with other nursing students. As she described the scene, the way she survived from, well, the earthquake hit at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. She was dug out the next morning at about 11 o'clock, those 18 hours. The dead students around her, she drank their blood to survive. Anything to survive. And now they are hoping to get her help as soon as we could. We reached her father, Patrick Sherry. He lives in Columbia, Maryland, to talk to him, to say we'd been with his daughter, we touched his daughter, that she wanted us to call. He had a Creole interpreter there, and we just talked about his daughter, to tell him that she is alive. We reached Dr. Eric Tom last night, the doctor who first told us about this story late last night when we came back into the United States. And he said, in fact, Patricia has now been transferred to a Medicine Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders hospital or clinic for further treatment. And we will try to get the latest on her case to keep you updated. We were speaking to Patricia in the back of Matthew 25 house, where this house that's usually a place for some 35 visitors has now extended into the soccer field of about 1,000 people, people who are being treated in various levels, stages of injury, and others who are not injured, but who have come from their devastated homes, no place to go, or simply afraid that their home could crumble still. Everyone is sleeping outside. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Alat ga kapu neg la kai Pasit ga yon bakay pay Na yon peyi pa gen travay Ya pi ou li yon tre san ray Tout la jounen neg pa travay Si moun yo pa ka l'ekol Gangoutou ni prêt pour faire fou. La pimande qui ça pour faire. Des fois me senti moi ta crié. Ou des fois me senti moi ta relé. Des fois me senti moi ta crié. Bisan la caillou qui n'a misère. Des fois me senti moi ta crié. Ou des fois me senti moi ta relé. Fwa m senti mwen ta kriye Pizan la kayo ki nan mizè La mizè fè yo demoralize That's Thierry Raymond. We met him heading to Cap Haïtien, to Cape Haitian, as he heads to the United States. He actually won the Haitian equivalent of American Idol, and we'll bring you more on him tomorrow. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. When we were broadcasting yesterday in the morning next to the Port-au-Prince Airport, right in the property of the airport, we were surrounded by a sea, a map of the world of search and rescue teams, their national flags blowing in the wind. We saw Puerto Rico, Costa Rica, Britain, France, South Africa. We walked over to talk to the group that was closest to us, right behind us, right near Costa Rica. It was the French rescue workers. We talked to the head of the group. They're called Rescuers Without Borders. His name is Jean-Philippe Oustalet, who described the remarkable rescue that happened just 2 days ago of a 25-year-old Haitian woman, an accountant, who was buried under the rubble in a store for 7 days. He describes what happened.
Yesterday, on a trouvé une femme de 25 ans.
We found a woman of 25 years old.
On l'a vu à peu près, on l'a entendu, on l'a localisé à midi.
We localized
à midi.
À midi?
Ouais. 12 o'clock.
We found her at 12 o'clock in the morning.
Et ensuite, on l'a sortie à minuit, 2 heures, 12 hours.
We left at midnight.
12 hours pour l'évacuer.
We, and it took 12 hours to get her out.
And where was she? Which part of Port-au-Prince?
Où est-elle? Hein? Où était-elle?
Elle était, c'était un supermarché.
She was in a supermarket.
Supermarket. Et depuis 7 jours.
For 7 days.
Elle était dans un endroit, un mètre. Dans un mètre, caché dans, sous trois dalles. Il y avait trois étages.
She was in a place where there were three stories.
Disons qu'elle était à
un mètre.
She was about a meter away.
Et on pouvait toucher, we can touch his hand.
We could touch her hand. Yeah.
But c'était trop tassé.
But it was too tight.
Et on pouvait pas la sortir encore.
We couldn't get her out.
Et you could talk to her.
Il fallait travailler, can work, pour pas que ça s'écrase. Donc il a fallu consolider.
We had to consolidate it with support so it wouldn't crush her.
You could talk to her.
Tu peux parler avec elle?
Avec oui. Elle. Ah oui. Elle parlait français.
What was she saying to you?
Yes.
Elle nous racontait. Elle venait. His job is comptabilité.
She's an accountant.
Elle venait. She come to buy food.
She had come to buy food.
When
it fell down on her.
She did not have food or water.
No food. No water.
No.
No food, no water. Incroyable.
Incredible.
Une force de, une envie de vivre.
She had a desire to live.
J'ai jamais vu ça.
I have never seen that.
What did she say to you when you could touch her? She could talk, but you couldn't yet free her.
On lui a expliqué qu'on était là. Dès qu'on l'a touché, ben, ça a été merci. Alors qu'on n'est pas là pour avoir des merci.
We told her that we could get her, and she was saying thank you, but we told her we weren't there for the thank yous.
How did it make you feel?
Comment ça t'a, ça, votre sentiment?
En tant que I'm a soccerist.
I'm a.
It's 20 years who come. All the catastrophe.
I'm a search and rescue specialist, which has come for 20 years to all the catastrophes.
And, it's my better day. Yeah. Because I have found a lot of cadavres.
I found a lot of cadavers.
And when you found one life, fantastic.
Your best day? Your best day?
My best day. After, and of soccerist, because I have three best day when I know my wife and when my two children was born, and after yesterday.
Jean-Philippe Oustalet, head of Rescuers Without Borders, the team that had come to Haiti. Yes, one of the best days of his life, he said, in this horror show that is the earthquake that has rocked Haiti to the core. The figures now on are something like, 2 million people, perhaps homeless, either their homes destroyed or afraid to return to their homes. The numbers of people dead, we can't even know.
No, I don't think it will ever be known, the exact number of dead, because in a situation like this, with so many bodies being buried in mass graves and the record-keeping in Haiti not, at the level here as in the United States or other countries, it may be impossible to really tell the actual number
of dead. They're saying they've actually counted so far 75,000, something like that, bodies, but they're saying it could be 100,000, it could be 200,000. An entire country rocked by this horror. And the question is how they recover in two ways. One is the natural catastrophe, and the other is the infrastructure of Haiti. You yourself experienced an earthquake. When we were with Jean-Philippe Oustalet at the airport, right after we did the broadcast here, We didn't even know the level of the what's called an aftershock, which is actually an earthquake, that took place earlier in the day when we were unfortunately inside a house for a moment. It took place as the whole place rocked. And as we ran out, people were screaming, crying, hugging each other. But he talked about that. He said that they were going out yesterday because they didn't know how many people had died or were trapped in the rubble from that.
Well, and not only that, but the aftershocks sometimes are even more terrifying than the original earthquake. I remember in covering the Northridge earthquake in California more than a decade ago now, and I got there hours after the quake had occurred and was actually in my hotel room writing a story, on the 10th floor of a hotel writing a story, when all of a sudden an aftershock hit and the entire building started swaying. And I had not experienced the original earthquake, so I was not even aware what was happening until I rushed out into the hallway and saw one of the maids in the hotel who had actually been in the first earthquake, and she was essentially totally catatonic. She was on the floor yelling and screaming because she realized it was coming again. And that sense that the catastrophe that you've already been through is being visited on you again, those aftershocks can be even more psychologically terrifying than the original quake.
So you have, for the survivors, the fear of this happening again. And you also have the fact that so many of them have not gotten aid, have not gotten water, have not gotten food. In fact, yesterday, just before we left Haiti, we were walking around the airport, where there are huge pallets of aid, including medical supplies, food and water, sitting in the fields all over the tarmac.
Everywhere we have traveled, people have asked, where's the aid? Well, a lot of it appears to be here, right here at the Port-au-Prince Airport. People ask for water. They ask for food. And we see many, many pallets, thousands of bottles of water. We see some being loaded now onto a truck. But people are asking, where is it? Why isn't it coming to us faster? Most people haven't gotten it at all. Let's see where this water is going. So where is the water going?
U.S. Embassy.
To the U.S. Embassy?
Yes, sir.
Here in Port-au-Prince?
Yes.
A lot of people have been asking, where is the water for the people? There are thousands and thousands of bottles.
Oh, I don't know.
Where do you live? Where do you live?
I'm living in Port-au-Prince.
Do you have questions like that? Do you have questions like, where is the aid?
No.
Where is the water?
No.
Why?
Because I'm working for U.S. Embassy. I'm coming to pick up the orders to put them for U.S. Embassy.
And who gets it at the embassy?
In Taba.
In Taba. And who gets to drink this water?
I don't know.
Just one scene at the airport yesterday, finally seeing some of that water being taken and being told it was going to the U.S. Embassy. We don't know what would happen to the water there. Of course, there are large staffs that have come in from all over, but the question is, when will the Haitian people, all over, from Haiti to Laogan to Carrefour, the epicenter, the water, the food, have access to that?
You know, I mean, it's amazing. One of the things I mentioned to you before you left is I didn't really understand why the closest landmass to Haiti, other than the Dominican Republic, with which it shares an island, is Cuba. And in fact, the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base is very close to Haiti. There are 9,000 U.S. Marines there. They have their own desalinization plant because they had conflicts with Cuba in the past over water supplies. They have huge reservoirs of water. It would have been really a quick action on the part of the United States to send a few thousand of those Marines immediately to Haiti in the first days with the water and the earth-moving equipment and all that stuff that's right there in Guantanamo. And imagine the image of Guantanamo to the world as, instead of being a place that just tortures prisoners, that the Marines on Guantanamo had moved quickly in the first few days to assist the people in Haiti. Didn't happen, and it took a, even now, it's a, about a couple of thousand of U.S. soldiers are there, and they're not necessarily playing the most, the best role that they can in this situation. So it just baffles me that they didn't immediately bring the people in Guantanamo into action.
I mean, China sent a plane, one of the first halfway around the world. Yes. But Juan, you just mentioned prisons, and let's go to that issue now, because all the prisoners jailed at the National Penitentiary in Port-au-Prince escaped in the earthquake, at least those who didn't die, and we don't have figures on this. In a few minutes, we're going to bring you an interview with the leading Haitian human rights attorney, who says 80% of all prisoners in Haiti were never even charged with a crime. He said the earthquake set them free. But first, we're going to go to a man, if you've been watching Democracy Now!, you're familiar with, because yesterday we brought you the piece where he toured us around the General Hospital of Port-au-Prince, a part of which, by the way, since we were there, had to be evacuated because of the aftershock. His name is Dr. Evan Lyon. He's with Partners in Health. And he started to talk about the issue of the prisons.
The National Penitentiary held 4,000 prisoners. We know that 60 to 80% of them are not convicted of anything. They're in prolonged pretrial detention. The average pretrial detention is a year. So between time of arrest and accusation to the time you see a judge, the average is a year. Sometimes that's out to two, and sometimes that's out to three. It's a fairly common practice in Haiti. If someone who's accused can't be found, a family member will be picked up. The lies that criminals have been released into the street is a lie. 60 to 80% of these people are not convicted of anything. And so there are other things to deal with, but I think that's a very important piece of the puzzle. The Bureau des Avocats International, Mario Joseph, Brian Kincannon, and I, with Partners in Health, we've been working for the last year to provide medical care and legal service in three of the in the provincial prisons, where we have a system where to give medical care that's never given, and to provide legal access, which is also never given, and so that's starting to roll. In with so many people in prison without sentence and without conviction, it might be looked at as positive that the prison is destroyed.
That's Dr. Evan Lyon. We're speaking to him at the General Hospital in Port-au-Prince. And you heard him mention Mario Joseph, one of Haiti's most prominent human rights attorneys. Well, for more on this issue, we spoke with Mario Joseph, who for years has fought for the rights of political prisoners, including many opponents of the 2004 coup that ousted Haiti's democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Mario Joseph's current clients include Ronald Dauphin, an activist with Aristide's La Valasse party, who was arrested by armed paramilitary troops one day after the coup. Dauphin was held without charge up until last week, when the National Penitentiary in Port-au-Prince collapsed, freeing him and the 4,000 other prisoners inside. Mario Joseph began the interview by describing his role as an attorney. He's translated by Haiti Liberté's Kim Ives.
My name is Mario Joseph.
C'est avocat défenseur droit de l'homme.
I'm a human rights lawyer.
Et je travaille avec prisonniers politiques, avec monde qui est pauvre et qui vole les droits en Haïti.
I work with political prisoners in the poorest country, the poorest people in the country.
The prison is empty now. Can you talk about the significance of that?
They say in French, for some things, bad things are good. And I think this catastrophe, which did a lot of damage in Haiti, it's released. This earthquake, it gave justice to the people in the prison, above all the political prisoners like Ronald
Dauphin.
And this will make 6 years since Ronald Dauphin has been in prison without charges, without ever being charged. Not only Ronald Dauphin, but a lot of other people who are in prison.
And
they would have, if they judged them, they would have left prison a long time ago.
Ronald Dauphin, why was he put in prison?
Bon, Ronald Dauphin en prison,
Ronald Dauphin is in prison.
Pour question un événement qui passait dans la Syrie, dans Saint-Marc avant
an incident
that fait là.
an incident that happened in La Syrie in Saint Mark before the coup d'état. We're talking about the coup d'état of February 29, 2004. It's a typically political dossier.
Et parce que monde qui t'a fait coup d'état yo,
because the people who made the coup d'état,
juger certains monde qui pré qui était pré régime et président Aristide là.
Because the people who made the coup d'état wanted to judge some of the people close to the government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
Et comme ça, gouvernement Canada baille l'argent et l'organisation yorele NCHR.
The government of Canada gave money to an organization called NCHR, a National Coalition for Haitian Rights.
Bon, moi c'est non ça me connaît parce que il change non et parce que branche New York là et dit yo pas j'ai fonctionné pas fonctionner sous même nom.
They changed their name because they said after that they couldn't use the function under the same name. Now they're called the National Network of Defending Rights in Haiti. Changing the name doesn't mean they've changed their attitudes. They put together dossier and that's how they put a lot of people in prison. The Prime Minister Yvonne Neptune.
Ministre intérieur et privé Jocelyn Privert.
The Interior Minister Jocelyn Privert.
Et député Amanis Mayet.
And Deputy Amanis Mayet.
Et Ronald Dauphin.
Ronald Dauphin.
Et un pile l'autre monde était en prison.
And a lot of other people were in prison.
So talk about who gets put in prison. How long do they stay? How many of them had not been charged?
Jusqu'à présent,
up until now, nothing has happened because there haven't been any charges. But for certain people like the Prime Minister, according to the Constitution of 186,
juger dans un tribunal ordinaire
parce que c'est un monde politique in an ordinary court
malgré
nous t'ai
fait
bruit,
nous t'ai dit ça mais on t'ai kembel en prison même pour 25 mois
but even though we said that they kept him in prison for 25 months
et après inauguration président Préval gen certain monde
after the inauguration of president Préval there were certain people
et yo mettait dehors tant que ministre intérieur
which they freed like the interior minister
et tant que ancien député Amanis Mayet
like former deputy Amanis Mayet
jusqu'à présent yo kembe Ronaldo
But up until now, they kept Ronald Dauphin in prison because he was less well-known. And that's the system of exclusion in Haiti.
Explain how many people haven't been charged in who were in prison, how many people were there without trial.
Generally, in the Haitian prisons,
tout le monde d'accord, il y a près de 80% moun yo ki nan prison yo
everybody agrees that there are about 80% of the people are not charged
et c'est seulement anticras soit 10%
it is only a few maybe 10% which are convicted
et qu'après tant une ordonnance pour que vous voyez dans tribunal mais ça va prendre pile temps
those are waiting an order to be sent to
et contrairement à la loi en Haïti parce que c'est seulement ça t'a fait 3 mois j'aime ça tout à l'heure on a le pral gain 6 ans premier mars là
and that's supposed to be done in 3 months and he's been waiting 6 years he's never been judged
dans toute prison c'est près de 90% moun yo
90% are not judged are not even charged.
Bon, ça, c'est dans le système, non?
That's in the system, and that's what I'm telling you.
Événement, ça,
this event, this earthquake, it's justice with the getting the people out of jail. The other thing I can say, in Haiti, we have a symbolic.
For example, a palais qui crasé.
The palace went down, the Palace of Justice, the Haitian IRS, and the whole power of the state. This was like a message that was sent. Because it wasn't just the people in prison who were suffering injustice, but the poorest in the country, the excluded in the country. This, I think, it was a clear message. It was a symbolic thing for the people who are the chiefs in the country and the government to know how to serve the people. To stop the exclusionary system which was there for 200 years.
And yet, so many. people died, poor Haitians simply died.
It is true that
many of the poorest people, they did die.
It is
true that many people
who had
good education, directors who also died. But it hit primarily the poorest people. Because they didn't have good houses, they didn't have good places and security where they
lived. The way
the earthquake hit, it didn't discriminate.
That's
a good example for us to look at in
Haiti.
And stop with this exclusionary system. It's true, a lot of poor people were touched by this. But even people with big houses or small houses, everybody's living in the street now. This is why we have to begin in the system of exclusion for everybody to participate in the country's life.
And
this is the message I would send to the Haitian government, which is always slow to send it to the poorest people.
That was Mario Joseph, Haitian human rights attorney, speaking to us in Port-au-Prince late yesterday. I want to issue a special thanks to my colleagues as we stood together and reported together through these days in Haiti, to Sharif Abdelkadous, to Elizabeth Press, to Kim Ives, who worked with us from Haiti Liberté. Tomorrow we'll bring you a special on the journey from Port-au-Prince to Laogan, really the epicenter of the earthquake, the question being asked everywhere. If the aid is at the airport, if all of these countries are working so hard to bring in people from search and rescue to water to food, why is it that the Haitian people have largely felt untouched by that support? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
To our office was really hurt.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We end today's show in Massachusetts, where a little-known Republican state senator has stunned many by winning the Senate seat held by the late Ted Kennedy for over four decades. Scott Brown's victory on Tuesday over State Attorney General Martha Coakley throws into doubt whether the Democrats will be able to move forward on passing health care reform this year. Once Brown is sworn in, the Republicans will control 41 seats in the Senate, enough to filibuster the legislation. Much of the Democratic establishment is debating who should be blamed for the stunning loss. Some have criticized Coakley for being a weak campaigner. Others cite President Obama's failure to mobilize his supporters to come out on Election Day. Many progressive Democrats say Obama has demobilized the base of the party by aligning with Wall Street and insurance companies.
The news analyst Norman Solomon wrote yesterday, quote, "The Democratic leadership on health care and so much else, including bank bailouts, financial services, foreclosures and foreign policy, has been so corporate that Republicans have found it easy to play populist. Well, to talk more about this election, we're going to go to Massachusetts right now, to Boston, to the attorney and activist John Boniface. He joins us, actually, from Chicopee, Massachusetts. In 2006, he ran for Secretary of State of Massachusetts as a Democrat. In 1988, he served as the scheduler for Senator Ted Kennedy's reelection campaign. John Boniface, can you tell us what happened in Massachusetts?
Well, there's no question, Amy, that this election has sent shockwaves across the establishment here in Massachusetts, the Democratic Party leadership, as well as in Washington. And the fact is that Scott Brown, the Republican candidate, was able to ride a wave of populist anger against the status quo, a wave that was misdirected toward him because the Democratic candidate, Martha Coakley, did not stand on progressive principles, nor was able to run on a platform, both from Washington as well as from Massachusetts, that matched where people need to be. I completely agree with Norman Solomon on this. The Democratic Party needs to stand on principle. It needs to return to basic principles of FDR, return to getting people back to work, focusing on Main Street, not Wall Street, and ensuring that it's standing up to corporate America. And instead, unfortunately, too many of the policies appear more and more to being aligned with Wall Street, and that hurt the Democratic campaign here.
Well, John Boniface, we've heard a lot in the last day or two about the Obama administration trying to come forward with a much more economic, populist message. How does he do that with Larry Summers to his left and Tim Geithner to his right?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think those two individuals in particular need to go, first of all, and members of Congress have stated that. And I think it's time that there be a dramatic shift in the Obama administration if it's going to make for a competitive environment in 2010. You know, Massachusetts obviously is seen as a one-party state, and most of its offices are filled by Democrats. But the fact is that there is populist anger out there, including here in this state, and we need to respond to it. Progressive Democrats of America is an example of an organization that stands up for basic progressive principles, and the party leadership needs to listen more to groups like that in order to show some leadership.
We're talking to John Boniface, who is an attorney in Massachusetts. Let's talk about health care in Massachusetts, because it's often talked about as a model for the country. People in Massachusetts may understand what is being proposed more than most others in the country. How did that play in here?
Well, this has to be remembered. This is a plan that mandates that people buy insurance, but doesn't provide the kind of strong public option that has been pushed for in Washington. And so at the end of the day, this is a plan that, while I think has key principles for advancing reform, ultimately is not real reform in the way that we need it. We need to take on the insurance industry and the healthcare industry and their lobbies and demonstrate that healthcare is a right, a human right, not a business for profit. And the moment we continue to go down the road of privatizing healthcare further, which is what this plan does here in Massachusetts, is when we lose people. We lose people understanding why should they be forced to buy insurance when they're not getting the kind of basic assistance they need. And to export that to the nation, for a lot of people, did not make sense.
John, I wanted to turn to another subject. The Supreme Court has announced it will hold a special public session today at 10 a.m. There's speculation the court will issue its long-awaited decision in one of the most important campaign finance cases in years. The case is Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission. As a longtime advocate for campaign finance reform, can you talk more about the significance of this case?
There's no question that this case is being closely watched by people around the country who care about the integrity of our elections and whether or not the right to vote will be upheld and people be able to have their voice heard in the political process. What this decision could do, according to the way the Supreme Court is moving it forward, is it could involve overturning century-old precedent that prohibits corporate money in our elections and would essentially allow corporations to spend billions and billions of dollars of their general treasury funds in our campaigns, drowning out political voices, ordinary citizens' political voices. And that is a complete danger to our democracy. It ought to be seen as a direct threat. And obviously, the hope is that the court will not go all that way. But if they do, organizations like Voter Action, where I serve as legal director, and others will be leading the charge to say we've got to stop treating corporations as persons under the First Amendment, and we certainly make sure the corporations not have free speech rights in the political process. So voteraction.org is a place people should go to hear about the response.
John Boniface, let's relate the issue of campaign finance back to what happened in Massachusetts and to the whole country. Talk about what happens now with the, well, the number 60, that golden number the Democrats no longer have, and where campaign finance, how you see the industries that have President Obama has cloaked himself with, from the insurance industry that would profit so much from the plan he wants to put forward, to Wall Street, determining what is taking place and perhaps this loss for the Democrats in Massachusetts.
Well, absolutely. The fact is that we've got to return to people-centered politics, where people control the process, not corporations. And when you have money-drenched interests controlling the politics in Washington, you lose people at the grassroots level. You lose people on Main Street who are suffering, who are losing their jobs, who don't have real health care. And so, you know, having Wall Street control the way we define our politics in Washington, I think, really makes it difficult for people like Martha Coakley, running as a Democrat here in Massachusetts, to prevail. No one should be looking at this as solely a race in which the candidate on the Democratic side made mistakes. There's no question she did. But the blame has to be shared with Democratic leadership in Washington that has not stood up on populist principles to stand up to corporate America. So from a campaign finance perspective, we've got to deal with how do we change our politics. And one major way we do that is shifting from a control of corporate-dominated interests to one in which we, the people, rule the process, and that's through public funding of elections, and it's also ultimately through challenging corporations being treated as persons under the First Amendment.
And John, this issue of the 60 votes needed in the Senate, throughout the long period that the Republicans were in control of both the House and the Senate, you rarely heard about the need to get 60 votes to do anything. Suddenly, it became a big issue now in this with the Democrats in control now. There are those who say that the Obama administration should make more conciliation and efforts to reach out to Republicans. I'm sure that's going to be a major thrust of some of the tactics of the Democrats. But what about the issue of actually going to battle over the fact that the Democrats still have a majority in the Senate and force those Republicans, if they're going to filibuster stuff, to do it and wage a public campaign against them?
Well, right. I mean, here, first of all, the way we engage in dealing with the filibuster now is we simply get the threat and then we don't bring the bill to the floor. Rather than forcing the opposition party, in this case the Republicans, to actually filibuster, to read from the phone book for days and days. Imagine if Republican after Republican got up on the floor of the Senate and read for days and days from the phone book, filibustering and shutting the Senate down. For what? Because they don't believe in health care reform, that would change the debate. But in addition to that, we have to remember that Democrats control the Senate, they control the House, they control the White House. And with 51 votes, including Vice President Biden's vote, Democrats can work through the reconciliation process to get something passed. But that something has to be real reform. It ought to be something that stands on basic core principles. And dare I say, principles that Senator Kennedy stood for in the so many years that he led the party. So I think that we have to go back to the question of people-centered politics and making sure that we control the process, not corporations.
John Boniface, I want to thank you for being with us, attorney and activist in Massachusetts. This is Democracy Now! We want to thank all the team that makes this broadcast possible, among them Mike Burke, Shrufa Dokadus, Aaron Mata, Angela Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Masood, Robbie Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Peter Curries, Miguel Laguerre, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Nick Gilla, Julie Crosby, Karen Renucci, Hugh Grant, Samantha Chambly, Jessel Noor, John Gerberg, Rakan Penny, Kellen Innocent, Vesta Goddars. Tonight, I'll be speaking at the Great Hall of Cooper Union, part of their event honoring 150 years of Cooper Union, with dramatic performances of the speeches there of Eugene V. Debs, Mother Jones, Emma Goldman, Norma Thomas. I will also be doing a report back on Haiti, 6:30 at the Great Hall, Cooper Union. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.